So as I said, I'm going to be talking about, what I'm going to be talking about today is basically a way to understand symmetry-protected topological phases, which you can think of as some kind of generalization of topological insulators. And it's a way to understand them based on looking at braiding statistics. So I'll get into that in more detail. This work that I'm going to talk about, I'm going to be talking about symmetry-protected topological phases in two dimensions, in two spatial dimensions, and also in three dimensions. The work in two dimensions is sort of older work, and that was done in collaboration with Zhen Chenggu, who's right here at Perimeter. And the 3D work, which is a little bit more recent, was done in collaboration with my postdoc, Chenji Wang, and a student, Chen-Hung Lin. Okay, so to start off, I want to first just tell you what is a symmetry-protected topological phase. As I said, it's some kind of generalization of topological insulators to more general types of symmetry groups and also to general spatial dimension. So I'll give you one definition. There are actually several competing definitions, but let me give you one definition and the definition I'll use in this talk. So what we have in mind is a symmetry-protected topological phase is a gapped quantum many-body system. So it's a quantum many-body system with an energy gap. And it could be quite a general many-body system. It could be built out of bosons or fermions. And as I said, it could be in any spatial dimension. In this talk, we'll mostly have in mind something like a lattice spin model. But in general, you could think of a collection of fermions or a collection of bosons as long as they have local interactions and they have an energy gap. Okay, so it's a gap quantum many-body system, and it has two key properties, two defining properties. So the first property is that this system has some set of symmetries that are unbroken. They're not broken either explicitly or spontaneously. That is, there's some set of symmetries that commute with the Hamiltonian, and they are not only do they commute with the Hamiltonian, but they also preserve the ground state. They're not broken spontaneously. Now, the symmetries I have in mind here are actually going to be on are a particular type of symmetry. You should think of them as internal or on-site symmetries, like Ising symmetry or spin rotation symmetry. I'm not going to be thinking about symmetries like spatial symmetries, like translational symmetry or reflection symmetry. So we have some set of symmetries which aren't broken. That's the first property. And then the second property is that the ground state is short-range entangled. Now, by short-range entangled, roughly speaking, what that means is that the ground state is very similar to a product state. Okay, it's basically a product state up to some very local correlations or local entanglement, short-range entanglement. And the precise definition is that a short-range entangled state is a state which you can turn into a product state by applying some local unitary transformation. I'll say what a local unitary transformation is in a second. But what that means is I can apply some unitary transformation U to psi and get a product state. That is some kind of tensor product of states on different, these are supposed to be states on different sites in my, let's say, my lattice. So this might be spin up, this is spin down, this is spin to the right. So it's a product of local states. If it's a boson system. If it's a fermionic system, then we would replace this product state with an atomic insulator. So it's a very kind of the most trivial state you can make out of fermions. So a short-range entangled state is something you can turn into a product state or an atomic insulator by some local unitary transformation. And what is a local unitary transformation? Well, one way to define it is it's a unitary transformation that can be generated by time evolution of some local Hamiltonian for some finite period of time. So it can be written as exponential of iht, where h is some local Hermitian operator. I shouldn't call it a Hamiltonian because it doesn't necessarily have anything to do with the physical Hamiltonian. It's just some local Hermitian operator, and it's evolved for some finite period of time. So intuitively, a local unitary transformation is just something that's basically mixes degrees of freedom that are very near each other. So it's made up of, hence the name, local unitary transformation. Okay, so basically, an SPT phase is just a state which is, its ground state is almost a product state, and it has some set of symmetries. Okay, but of course, you know, if this is the only definition you give, there's a very trivial example of an SPT phase, which is basically a Hamiltonian which has a product state as its ground state. You could easily come up with a Hamiltonian with a product state, ground state, which has some set of symmetries. And of course, by definition, the ground state would be short-range entangled. You could just choose U to be the identity operator. So that's a particular example of an SPT phase, but it's a boring one. We would call that a trivial SPT phase. So what is a non-trivial SPT phase? A non-trivial SPT phase is something that's different from a product state. That is, we'll say an SPT phase is non-trivial if there's no way to adiabatically connect your Hamiltonian H to some other Hamiltonian we'll call H product, which has a product-like ground state. There's no way to smoothly connect the two Hamiltonians without either breaking the symmetry or closing the energy gap. You can't smoothly connect it while preserving the symmetry and the energy gap. So basically, a non-trivial SPT phase is one that is in a distinct phase from the product state. And maybe what's interesting is that non-trivial SPT phases exist at all, because you might naively think that if your state is short-range entangled, that is, if it can be converted into a product state by some local unitary transformation, then it's probably in the same phase. But that's not necessarily the case, and the reason is that this unitary transformation in general may not commute with your symmetry. So just because there exists some unitary transformation which converted to a product state doesn't mean that you can smoothly connect the two while preserving the symmetry. So let me give you some examples. Oh, actually, one more fact before I give you examples. So far, I've given you a very abstract definition of SPT phases. But really, what makes them interesting physically is this final property, which is that, and this is not part of the definition. This is more maybe a consequence. So non-trivial SPT phases have a very interesting property, which is that they tend to have protected boundary modes. Maybe they always have protected boundary modes, but I don't think we know that for sure. So I'm just going to say they typically have protected boundary modes. So what do I mean by that? Well, imagine we define our Hamiltonian in some system, some finite system with a boundary. So in the bulk of the system, as I said, there's going to be some energy gap. And the statement here is that under very general conditions, more or less, you could imagine choosing some arbitrary kind of boundary Hamiltonian here at the boundary. And under very general conditions, you'll find that even though there's a gap in the bulk, when you look at excitations near the boundary, you can find arbitrarily low energy excitations. And I haven't been precise under exactly what conditions. Maybe I'll get into that in more detail later in the talk. But they're under quite general conditions. And that's why we say that these boundary modes, these gapless modes, are in some sense protected. They come from the bulk, and they're more or less independent of the choice of the boundary Hamiltonian. Yeah.
Just regardless of what symmetries the boundary Hamiltonian obeys.
Okay, so I was trying to avoid getting into this, but that's right. So maybe I should be more precise. So the more precise statement is that these gapless modes here cannot be broken as long as the boundary Hamiltonian doesn't break the symmetry explicitly or spontaneously. And if you're in more than two dimensions, you also have to impose one other condition, which is that your boundary condition doesn't your ground state doesn't have topological order. That's another technical condition. But as long as it doesn't break the symmetry and it doesn't introduce topological order, then you can prove that the boundary is guaranteed to be gapless. This is a very strong statement. It's not a perturbative statement. It's independent. You can make this boundary Hamiltonian basically arbitrary strength relative to the gap and so on. It doesn't matter.
But if I add some small symmetry breaking perturbation on the boundary, just like a topological state, I only break the temporals on the boundary.
Yeah, that's right.
Is that still something non-trivial or?
No, so what I said here was you're guaranteed to be gapless as long as you don't break the symmetry explicitly or spontaneously or introduce topological order. The example you gave breaks the symmetry spontaneously at the boundary.
If you explicitly just break symmetry on the boundary, can I still see something non-trivial on the boundary or?
Well, you won't see a gapless spectrum. That's all I'm talking about here.
It's gapped, but it's still something non-trivial.
Well, I don't know I won't get into that. I'm just talking about the existence of gapless modes. Okay, so this is probably the most interesting property of SPT phases, but again, it's not really the definition. The definition is that you have asymmetries and your state is basically a product state. So what are some examples? So the example that, probably the most famous example are topological insulators. So these are systems made out of electrons. They can exist, or fermions. They can exist in two and three dimensions. And the basic symmetry in that case is charge conservation and time reversal symmetry. So let's just see that they have those properties that I suggested. So They have some set of unbroken symmetries, namely charge conservation and time reversal. The ground state is short-range entangled because that's just the statement that I can take my, basically that's because my ground state can be, we know that a topological insulator can be turned into an atomic band insulator if I'm allowed to break the symmetries. So there exists some unitary transformation which will take my ground state and turn it into some atomic insulator, but it will violate the symmetries. And then the third property is it's non-trivial. You cannot take a topological insulator and change it into an atomic insulator without breaking either time reversal or charge conservation symmetry or closing the energy gap. And of course, the final property is topological insulators do indeed have these protected boundary modes that are protected by those two symmetries of charge conservation and time reversal. So that's one example. Another example is the Haldane spin 1 chain. And that's a 1D system made of spins, a 1D spin chain, and the key symmetry there is time reversal. And again, you can show that this state, it has some symmetries which are not broken, namely time reversal. The ground state is short-range entangled. It can be converted into a product state by some local unitary transformation, but it can't be smoothly connected to that product state without breaking symmetry. So it's a non-trivial phase, and it also has boundary modes. In this case, the boundary modes are just some degenerate degrees of freedom at the ends of the chain. Okay, so that's another example. Now, these are just two of the most famous examples. There are, of course, many other examples in many different spatial dimensions and many different types of symmetry groups. Okay, so that's a symmetry protective phase. So what are the basic questions, the sort of fundamental questions about these phases? Well, there are sort of two questions that I think are particularly basic. So one question is kind of a question of classification. And this is sort of a question, if you like, of counting number of phases. So the question is, if you give me a symmetry group and you tell me the spatial dimension, I should be able to tell you how many distinct phases there are with that symmetry group in that spatial dimension, how many distinct SPT phases there are. So it's kind of a counting question, but it's an interesting one. And it's been answered in some cases. In particular, the one case where I think we have a more or less complete answer is if we consider systems of non-interacting fermions. So for those systems, we have more or less complete classification. We know exactly how many phases there are in each spatial dimension with each symmetry group. And that was done by Schneider and collaborators and Kataev. There's also been some progress on the case of boson systems, general boson systems with interactions. There's been some conjectures for how to classify these phases, how to count how many phases there are. And that's based on something called cohomology, and that was done by Chen, Gu, Lu, and Wen. It's not clear, this is a conjecture, so I'm just going to state it now, but there's some conjecture for at least a partial classification. So that's one set of results. Now, that's one basic question. The other question is one of characterization. So here the question is not how many phases there are, but rather, what are their properties? Or more precisely, you could ask the following very basic question. If you give me a microscopic Hamiltonian, how do I know? I should be able to tell you which phase it belongs to. I should be able to tell you, is it in SPT phase? And I should be able to tell you which one it's in. Or maybe even more basically, if you give me two Hamiltonians, I should be able to tell you if they belong to distinct phases or the same phase. Okay? And that's the question I'm going to focus on in this talk. So I want to sort of give you some approach for at least partially answering this question. Okay. So what is the basic approach? So let me just give you the really crude picture, and then I'll get into more details and give you an example. So the basic idea, the approach I'm going to talk about, it's going to be able to partially answer that question of telling whether two Hamiltonians belong to distinct phases for a particular case. So in particular, I'm going to be thinking about systems with unitary symmetries. So I'm not thinking about time reversal. I'm thinking about unitary symmetries like spin rotation symmetry usually I'm going to be talking about discrete symmetries like Ising symmetry. And so for any such Hamiltonian, I'm going to give you some way to tell what phase it belongs to, or more precisely, whether two Hamiltonians belong to distinct phases. So how does that work? Well, basically, the idea is very simple. If you have some Hamiltonian with some unitary symmetry, what you can do is you can gauge that symmetry. So you can couple the system to a gauge field. I'll explain how to do that. And that gives you if you like, a gauge theory, which I'll call H gauge. So for every Hamiltonian H, I can define a corresponding gauge theory, H gauge. Then what I can do is look at the excitations of this gauge theory. Now, I should have said this before, but SPT phases, because their ground states are basically product states, their excitations are really boring. They never have any excitations with fractional statistics or interesting braiding statistics. They're always just something really boring because they're basically product states. On the other hand, so if I thought about the braiding statistics for my original Hamiltonian, that's not interesting. But the idea is once I gauge my symmetry, I now have a gauge theory. This has different sets of excitations from my original Hamiltonian. It has more excitations. And I can look at the excitations here and I can study their braiding statistics. And in general, the gauge theory will have interesting braiding statistics. And I can extract some data that describes that braiding statistics. And the idea is that this braiding data is kind of like you can think of it as an invariant. This data doesn't, if I change my Hamiltonian by some small amount, or I smoothly, adiabatically change my Hamiltonian while preserving the symmetry, this will not change. So if I have two Hamiltonians with different types of braiding data, with different data here, I know they belong to distinct phases. So what I'm going to try to show you is that that basic approach works in many cases, may work in some sense all cases, we don't know. So the first type of result I'm going to show you is that we can distinguish many different SPT phases. So there are many examples where I can show you that two Hamiltonians belong to distinct phases by comparing their braiding statistics. The other thing I want to tell you is that we can also understand one of the key properties of SPT phases, namely the existence of their boundary modes. So I'll show you, I'll give you some general arguments that if you have non-trivial braiding data, I'll explain what non-trivial really means, then you can prove that your original Hamiltonian must have protected boundary modes. So it also gives you some insight into the gapless modes. So those are the two types of results I'm going to talk about. So I don't know if there are any questions about that before I go on.
This is all done in the bulk, right?
Yes. All of this is properties of the bulk, but I'm going to connect it with the boundary, hopefully, if I have time. OK. So now let me give you an example of how this general approach works. So I'll start with the simplest possible example. So I'm going to talk about 2D spin system with Z2 symmetry. It gives one of the simplest examples where one can talk about SPT phases. So according to the conjecture of Chen, Gu, Lu, and Wen, there are two distinct SPT phases with Z2 symmetry in two dimensions. So one of these phases is trivial. It's basically a product state. And one is non-trivial. OK. So you can think of these as two types of Ising paramagnets. They're paramagnets because they don't break the symmetry spontaneously. So what I want to do first for you is just give you some microscopic models for these two phases. And then I'm going to try to prove to you they belong to distinct phases by looking at their braiding statistics, by gauging them and looking at their braiding statistics. OK, so what is the microscopic model? So both phases can be realized by a microscopic model, which is a spin 1/2 system on the triangular lattice. So each one of these dots is a spin 1/2. So first, I should tell you how the symmetry is defined. So the symmetry is defined to be product. P labels the different sites of this lattice. Product of sigma xp, where sigma x is the Pauli matrix. So this symmetry, if you think about it in the sigma z basis, this is the usual Ising symmetry. It maps up spins to down spins and down spins to up. So sort of the usual Ising symmetry. So that's the symmetry. What are the Hamiltonians? Well, the first one of the Hamiltonians, the Hamiltonian for the trivial phase, is of the form. It's just the minus the sum over all sites sigma xp. It's pretty clear this is. You can see this commutes with your symmetry. So it is indeed has this Ising symmetry. And it's also pretty clear that it's a trivial state because its ground state is just going to be some product state. All the spins point in the x direction. This is what you'd call a trivial paramagnet. OK, so that's kind of the boring case. The more interesting one is the following Hamiltonian. So it's a Hamiltonian. It's a sum over p of some operator called b sub p. And B sub P is a 7-spin interaction that involves a central spin and its 6 neighbors. It's not a very realistic interaction. I've chosen it because it's exactly solvable. It's kind of a toy model you can solve exactly. So what is the what is this B sub P operator? Well, it's a it acts like sigma x on the center spin, and then it has this product. This is a product over triangles, P, Q, Q prime. So this is a triangle. Over all six triangles, and for each triangle, you have this factor of I to the 1 minus sigma ZQ prime over 2. Details aren't so important. The main thing I want to mention is that this whole factor here, if you think in the sigma Z basis, this whole factor here is just a plus a factor of plus or minus 1. You can check that. Maybe I shouldn't go into that. So this thing is very similar to the original Hamiltonian. You can think of it as almost like this sigma x term, but it has some factors of plus or minus 1 that depend on the neighboring six spins. And again, you can easily see that this is invariant under the symmetry, commutes with the symmetry. And in fact, you can also solve this model exactly, because it turns out these operators, they all commute with each other. Each B sub P commutes with every other B sub P. They all commute with each other, so you can find the ground state exactly and show that it's unique. Since you know it's unique, that means it can't break the symmetry spontaneously. Because if it broke the symmetry spontaneously, it would have it multiple ground states. OK, so that proves that this Hamiltonian has the icing symmetry. It doesn't break it explicitly or spontaneously. And the same is true for here. So the basic question is, they seem very similar from the point of view of symmetry. So how can we see that they belong to distinct phases? That's the first question. And the second question is, how can we see that H1 has a protected edge mode while H0 does not? Because they look, it's not obvious, right? So that's where I want to explain how this grading statistics approach can answer these questions. OK, so the first step of this approach is to couple your system to gauge the symmetry. Okay, this is Z2 symmetry, so we're going to introduce a Z2 gauge field. So how does that work? How do we gauge a symmetry? So there's a kind of general procedure I guess I'll outline for you. It's a fairly standard procedure. So the first thing you do is on each link, you introduce a new degree of freedom, which is the gauge field. And it's a Z2 gauge field, so it has a degree of freedom that can be in two states, plus one or minus one. Basically, the gauge field on this link can be the phase factor associated with this link can be either plus one or minus one. And I'm going to call that gauge field mu z pq. Okay, so that's the first step. The second step is kind of the minimal coupling procedure. So the idea is that there's a geometric picture for gauge theory, which is that it's like parallel transport. You parallel transport, if it's a U1 gauge field, you parallel transport your particle. If it carries some charge, then you have to introduce a phase associated with what path it moves across. Here, it's a Z2 gauge field. So if we parallel transport, say, sigma Z, across, we have to introduce a phase, which is plus or minus 1. So for example, if I have a term like this that couples two sigma Zs on these two sites, I should put in this extra factor of mu Z. This is like the parallel transport factor from transporting it across that link. So anytime I see a sigma Z, I have to put in this mu sub Z. The other rule is that if I have something which, so that's the reason I put in this factor here is sigma z is odd under the symmetry. Okay? The symmetry was product of sigma x, right? So this is odd under the symmetry. So it should always, we need to parallel transport it. But if I have an operator like sigma x, which is even under the symmetry, basically doesn't, then there's nothing that needs to be done. Sort of, if you like, it carries no charge. So there's no gauge field associated with that. So the basic prescription is anytime I see this factor, I put in a mu sub z. And anytime I see this, I don't change it at all. And that's it. The last step after you do minimal coupling is that there's one last thing. This isn't so important. This is more technical thing. We put in by hand an extra term in our Hamiltonian, which adds some energy for the gauge flux. So if this quantity is like the gauge flux through some plaquette, and we put in this term, which gives you some energy if there's non-zero gauge flux through that plaquette. Okay, so that's the prescription. So let me give you an example of how it works. So if you took this Hamiltonian H sub 1, the non-trivial one, and you gauge it, what happens? Well, So sigma x, you don't do anything to it because it's even under the symmetry. Sigma z, here we have a product of two sigma z's, so we have to introduce this mu sub z factor. And then finally, we put in this extra term here for the gauge to give some energy to the gauge field. There's one last technical point I don't know if I want to go into, which is that this gauging procedure, as I've defined, is actually a little ambiguous. So this procedure here makes perfect sense if you have a nearest neighbor coupling, like two spins that are right next to each other, you put in mu sub z. But what if I have two spins that are separated by some distance? Well, there, what you want to do is take a product of mu sub z along some path. But there are multiple paths you could pick. And there's really, it's ambiguous how you should write down this minimal coupling procedure. So to resolve that ambiguity, there's a way to do that. What we do is we multiply by this projector. And this projector basically projects onto having vanishing flux through every triangle in the neighborhood of your interactions. So this projector projects onto states where this product is 1 through every plaquette in the neighborhood of my interactions. So basically, I make sure there's no flux through any of the plaquettes near wherever my interactions are. And then it doesn't matter which path I pick when I define when I do this gauging procedure. It's a technical point, but that's why we introduced this one extra operator here. Anyway, this is a more or less up to the sort of technical points, a fairly standard way to take a Hamiltonian with some symmetry and convert it into a gauge theory.
Michael?
Yeah.
Can I ask you explain in detail how to do that in practice?
Yeah.
But these are particular proposals how to gauge the theory.
Yeah.
If I start with the simplizing model, may it be possible that there are other prescriptions how to gauge the symmetry that would produce the other topological things?
So let me see how to answer that question. So there are different prescriptions for how to gauge. There's different ways you can associate a gauge theory to an ungauged model. I think what all I can say is we give a particular prescription for doing it. The prescription we choose has some nice properties which allow us to make precise statements. If you choose some other way of doing it, then I won't be able to make some of the statements that I make. But you may or may not get the same answer.
But you have a procedure that you just described.
Yeah.
And given two theories, H0 and H1, which are not gauge theories, you produce two gauge theories.
That's right. But if you, for example, one thing that maybe I should mention at this point is what's very special about this prescription is in some sense the gauge coupling is 0. So usually when you introduce a gauge theory, the standard lattice gauge theory would also include a term that's like mu sub x, which gives some fluctuations to the gauge field. So if you turn up that term, make it large, for example, you'll be in a confining phase. So then, for example, all the stuff about statistics I say wouldn't hold. So, and also I wouldn't be able to make precise statements about this gauge theory. So what's nice about, so the prescription I've chosen here is one which is at 0 gauge coupling. So it means I can make very precise statements. For example, this will be important later. This Hamiltonian has the same energy gap as this Hamiltonian. Basically, it actually has the same low energy spectrum. So I can prove that this is going to be important. Basically, this procedure maps gapped Hamiltonians to gapped Hamiltonians. That's going to be important because it'll allow me to prove some results. If I put in some other terms and I turned up the gauge fluctuations, then I wouldn't be able to make statements about this Hamiltonian. I wouldn't be able to prove anything about it. And it could probably realize many, many phases.
But my question is really general. It's, you have H0 and H1. You have a prescription how to turn those, how to map those Hamiltonians
yes.
into gauge Hamiltonian
yes.
theories. The fact that these two gauge theories are different, how is that? How does this imply that there
Oh, so be- I'll get to that point. That involves this particular prescription that I've used here. So if you took a generic prescription, I couldn't prove that for you. Yes.
So would you require that any gauging procedure should give you two gauge theories that are different because these are two different SPT phases?
No, I think really I would just say intuitively, I can be precise or I can be intuitive. Intuitively, a good gauging procedure should be, the one procedures I have in mind is something like small gauge coupling, okay? And I'm actually working zero gauge coupling so I can be completely precise. But all the results that I give here should hold, I think, for any reasonable prescription at small gauge coupling. I think in some sense that's the definition of something at small gauge coupling is something that's smoothly connected to this theory. But certainly, if you do something at very large gauge coupling, you'd have some theory which would have nothing to do with what I'm talking about.
Can you Stevenian notion of a weak gauge topic for this difficulty?
Well, I think the precise notion here is that actually is that the flux through every plaquette commutes with the Hamiltonian. So there's no fluctuations in the flux. So in fact, flux gives you, there's infinite number of conserved quantities. All of these terms, product of mu sub z, through every plaquette, they all commute with the Hamiltonian. As a result, basically, I can prove as long as u is large, the ground state will have zero flux through every plaquette. And then once it has zero flux through every plaquette, you can see that your gauge theory basically reduces to your original theory, has the same energy spectrum. So when I say weak gauge coupling, what I mean is something that's probably close to the same Hamiltonian. That's what I really mean. Or something, yeah. But usually what people think of as gauge coupling is the coefficient of the mu sub x term, which gives you fluctuate in the Hamiltonian formulation. So here the coefficient of mu sub x is zero. So I think that's why I would say it's zero gauge coupling. Yes?
Can you gauge the continuous continuous
right. So we can talk about the continuous case. I think because you're working at zero gauge coupling, it would still be, everything would go through, but it becomes a little bit trickier to make things precise because now you actually are gapless. We could go into that, but I think it actually would work because you're doing zero gauge coupling. This is really just a trick. The gauge field here is not really essential. It's not really, it's dynamical, but in a sense it's not dynamical because the gauge field, these fluxes all commute with the Hamiltonian. So we really introducing the gauge field is just a way to probe the symmetry. I don't really want to introduce any, I'm not really interested in any dynamics coming with the gauge field. That's why making the gauge coupling zero. Okay, so you can probably get around this and not introduce the gauge field at all. Keep it completely non-dynamical, but that has its own subtleties. Okay, so after we've gauged our system, the next thing we want to do is look at excitations of our system. And there are two types of excitations for this Hamiltonian, for either of those Hamiltonians, H0 or H1. So the first type of excitation I'll call a charge excitation. And you can think of these as excitations in the original ungauged model. So the original ungauged model, remember, the Hamiltonian, let's say H0, was a sum of sigma x. And the ground state was a state where sigma x equals 1 on every site. But you could have an excitation where sigma x equals minus 1 on some site. You can think of this as a spin flip excitation, right? And that excitation, it's a pretty trivial excitation, but it carries, it's odd under the symmetry, right? Under the symmetry, this state has symmetry numbers. Its parity under Ising symmetry is minus 1. So when you couple to a gauge field, it actually becomes like a gauge charge. So that's why we call it a charge. So similarly, for the other Hamiltonian, the H sub 1 Hamiltonian, you can have a local excitation where B sub P equals minus 1. Again, it's odd under the symmetry, so when you couple to a gauge field, this becomes like a gauge charge. So these charge excitations you can think of as really coming from the original Hamiltonian. That's descended from excitations of the original Hamiltonian. So they're not actually that interesting. The interesting excitations is that when you gauge the theory, you introduce some new types of excitations. In particular, you can have what's called a pi vortex, these live on plaquettes. So you can have a pi vortex, which is a excitation where the product of mu sub z is equal to minus 1 instead of plus 1. We call it pi vortex because the phase when you go around here is pi rather than 0. And those live on plaquettes. And actually, there are two types of pi vortices in this system. And the reason is that for given any pi vortex, I can always create another type of pi vortex by attaching a charge to it. That's a distinct type of pi vortex. So I call those pi vortices MA and MB, the two types of pi vortices. So those are the basic excitations in my system. In both cases, in fact, for both H0 and H1, they have those excitations.
How do you attach them? How do I see the attachment?
So attachment here, I mean, it's not about energetics. No. It's just, I can always imagine bringing a charge near a flux. If you like, I mean, the fact that they're bound together isn't really important, but for their topological properties, I can imagine moving them as a pair or moving something around the pair. And as a pair, a flux plus a charge behaves differently from a flux by itself. So for example, if I bring another flux around it, putting an extra charge here is going to change that phase by pi.
But it's not like a dynamical bound state. It's just by hand.
Yeah, so in general, when we talk about different excitations in these types of, in topological phases, they're not necessarily, it's not about whether they're bound states. That really precise definition, if you like, an excitation of a topological phase is anything that could be that could be trapped by a local potential. So if you add some appropriate type of local potential, the ground state might contain both a flux and a charge. But it doesn't have to be a bound state of the original Hamiltonian. Does that make sense? Okay. So those are the different excitations. Now the last properties, we want to look at their statistics. And it turns out the interesting statistics have to do with the pi vortices, because these are the new things that we introduced when we gauged the system. So I'll just focus on that. So the basic question is, if we take two pi vortices and we can imagine exchanging them, and we can ask, what phase do we get? Okay. So you can actually do this calculation. The models are exactly solvable, so you can actually really exchange them on the lattice and see what happens. And what you find is that for the original Hamiltonian, the pi vortices are bosons or fermions. In fact, one of the pi vortices is a boson and the other is a fermion. And the reason they have different statistics is that when you attach a charge to a flux, it actually changes its statistics by pi. You can check that. So in this case, the pi vortices are bosons or fermions. In the other case, you find the pi vortices are semions or antisemions. What I mean by that is when I exchange them, instead of getting plus or minus one, like here, I get a phase of plus or minus I. And again, one pi vortex is a semion, the other one is an antisemion. And they have different statistics because when you attach a charge, it flips the statistics by pi. OK, so what we see here is we see a sharp difference in the statistics in these two systems. So now let's see what implication that has. So my claim is that proves that your original Hamiltonians must belong to distinct phases. They cannot be smoothly connected without closing the energy gap or breaking the symmetry. So how do you see that? Well, let's suppose you could smoothly connect them by some Hamiltonian H sub s. Well, I gave you some procedure for gauging H sub 0. And getting some gauge theory H sub 0. And I gave you some procedure for gauging H sub 1 and getting some gauge theory H sub 1. But that procedure, the way I define it, is very general. You could do it for any Hamiltonian with local interactions at Ising symmetry. And in fact, so I can define, I can gauge, if I had a smooth path connecting these two, I could gauge that and get a smooth path connecting these two. And now this is where the key point comes in with the way I define my gauging procedure. This Hamiltonian has the same energy gap as this Hamiltonian. So as long as the energy gap stays open here, the energy gap stays open here. Okay, but now we have a contradiction because these have different statistics. And we know that we can't smoothly change the statistics. They're kind of discrete numbers. They can't be smoothly changed. So you can't smoothly connect this gauge theory with this gauge theory, which means you couldn't smoothly connect this model and this model without breaking the symmetry. So that proves they belong to distinct phases. Is that clear? OK. And if you had given some other gauging procedure, you could try to make this argument, but it would start to be a little bit, you have to be careful because you have to work at weak gauge coupling because the key property is that this Hamiltonian is gapped if this Hamiltonian is gapped. Okay. All right, so what I've shown you is that this grading statistics approach allows us to prove that these two models, well, belong to distinct phases. And also, this I'm not going to talk about here today, but is I'll try to instead tell you an analog in higher dimensions. But you can also use this, you can also show, using the statistics, you can prove that H1 has protected edge modes that can't be gapped out without breaking the symmetry. And finally, I want to say, although I focused on these two models, you can actually obtain basically the same type of result for any of a whole large class of exactly solvable models. They're kind of generalizations of H0 and H1. Which for unitary abelian symmetry groups. For all of those models, we can prove they were conjectured to belong to distinct phases. We can prove they do belong to distinct phases and can also show that they have gapless edge modes. The non-trivial ones have gapless edge modes.
In all these cases, is it true that you just map it to different decompiled phases?
Yeah, they have different statistics. OK.
So have you proved that, have you actually
No, we don't know that. So that's why I said many. in quotes. We don't know if the statistics are different, we know they belong to different phases. If the statistics are the same, we don't know. They might belong to the same phases, but we don't know any examples of that. A priori, there's no proof of that. Okay, so now, I guess I have a few more minutes. So now what I want to do is discuss this sort of how to repeat this program in three dimensions. So let's try to do a similar thing in three dimensions. So what we're going to do, and this is going to be a little bit more abstract, the 3D discussion. So the starting point is we're going to take some spin model, which is short-range entangled, and has some symmetry group, a unitary symmetry group, G. And then what we're going to do is we're going to gauge the symmetry, and we're going to study the braiding statistics of the excitations in this gauge theory, and we're going to try to see if we can tell different spin models apart, okay, and maybe also understand their boundaries. So we're going to focus on a simplest case, which is a symmetry group of the form Zn to the k. It turns out this is general enough to have some interesting examples, but it's still pretty simple. But actually, everything I say also applies to general abelian symmetry groups. So more, it's just I'm going to focus on this for simplicity. Okay, so first let's think about the excitations in these gauge theories. And I'm just going to, again, I'm going to be a little bit abstract here. I'm not going to give you an exact model, because you can say quite a bit about the excitations just on general principles. You don't even have to have a model. So one type of excitation is charges. These are excitations that come from the original ungauged system. When you gauge it, that any excitation that carries some, that transforms non-trivially under the symmetry turns into a charge in your gauge theory. Now the charges in general are characterized by how much gauge charge they carry. And the gauge charge can be described by a k component integer vector, where each component tells you basically the amount of gauge charge in that, you know, it's zn to the k. So there's, it can carry k distinct charges, one for each of the zn's. And so it's described by a k component vector, and each component is an integer. It's defined modulo n because it's zn. So that's the gauge charge. And those are point-like excitations, okay, particle-like excitations. In addition to the charges, there's another type of excitation, which is like vortices, except in three dimensions, they become vortex loops. So these are loops along which the gauge flux is non-zero, okay? And loops are characterized by the amount of gauge flux that they carry. And the gauge flux is, again, a k-component vector, where each component is now some multiple of 2 pi over n, because, it's zn. Now, an important point is that gauge fluxes can also, vortex loops can also carry charge in addition to flux. And the reason is, just like in 2D, you can always attach a charge to a loop, and it gives you another type of loop. So that's important to keep in mind. Okay, so those are the basic excitations. Now we can start to think about their statistics. Again, let's just think on general grounds about their statistics. So there's sort of three types of processes you can think about. You can take charges and you can imagine exchanging them. You can take charges and you can imagine braiding them around loops. And then finally, you can take loops and braid them around each other. So let's think about them one at a time. So first, let's think about charges, their statistics. Well, I told you the charges come from the original ungauged model, basically. And the original ungauged model was short-range entangled by assumption. So its excitations are actually very boring. In fact, they have to all be bosons, because I'm assuming that we're starting with a bosonic model. It's a short-range entangled bosonic model. So the charges are all bosons, so their exchange statistics has to be zero. So that's boring. More interesting is you can imagine taking a charge and braiding it around a vortex loop. And there you can get something non-trivial. In fact, the phase that you get is exactly the Aronoff-Bohm phase. It's in some sense almost the definition of what a vortex loop is. If I braid a charge Q around a vortex loop carrying flux phi, the phase I get is Q times phi. Okay, so that's good. Now let's think about the next type of process. Let's think about braiding loops, vortex loops around each other. So for example, you might imagine taking one vortex loop. This is one particular way to braid them. Take one vortex loop and pass it through another, and then stretch it out and bring it back. Okay, so you shrink one of them smaller than the other. You pass it through, you stretch it out, you bring it back. And so we could ask, what about this? Could we get some interesting phases here? And in general, you might, right? This is kind of a non-trivial process. Maybe you can get something interesting. So let's think about that. Now, the first case to figure out what happens here, again, I'm going to use sort of general arguments. I want to focus on a simple case, which is I want to focus on the case where the two loops are neutral. And by that, I mean some of the loops will have the property that you can shrink them down to a point and annihilate them by a local gauge invariant operator. Those loops we'll call neutral loops. Other loops, you shrink them down, you can't annihilate them by a gauge invariant operator. Those are loops that carry, we'd say they carry charge. So let's first consider the case of neutral loops, ones that can be shrunk down and annihilated by a local operator. My claim is that if the loops are neutral, then the phase of braiding one around the other has to be zero on general grounds. So how do you see that? Well, I'm going to try to argue for it using a basic principle, which is that the statistical phase of braiding some excitation around another is a topologically invariant. It doesn't change if I smoothly deform my braiding path. Now, to make the pictures easier to draw, instead of showing you the whole braiding, I'm just going to imagine the two loops are perpendicular to this board. So this is where they puncture the board. So this is the loop alpha. It comes out and goes in. This is the loop beta. So I'm going to just show you pictures for how the punctures move. And hopefully it'll be clear. This is supposed to represent the braiding process where one loop goes around the other. Okay. So so what I said is, remember, I said the braiding phase, the statistics must be independent of sort of deformations of the braiding path, local deformations. So I can take this braiding path, I can imagine shrinking down alpha quite a bit. I shrink it down so it's pretty small in the interior region. And eventually, since alpha is neutral, I could shrink it down and basically annihilate it and then recreate it over here. So I can deform my path into something like this. And the statistics shouldn't change because this is a local deformation of my original path. So the phase associated with this path is the same as the phase associated with this path. Now what I do is I take beta and I start to shrink that down. Again, it shouldn't change the phase. And eventually I can shrink it down and annihilate it altogether. So now the phase should be the same as this path here. And now finally, just to make things symmetrical, I can now imagine instead of shrinking it down completely, I kind of undo this. I make it very small and I bring it back up. So I can reduce it to something like this. I can basically go back to where I started. Now you can see by these changes, I've shown that the phase of braiding alpha around beta is the same thing as the phase of braiding alpha around the vacuum. So basically, by definition, this phase, the statistical phase associated with braiding alpha around beta is trivial, zero, must be zero, if they're neutral.
Sorry, when you have that cut, what's happening to the actual loop?
Which one?
Sorry, between the first and the second diagrams, what are you doing for the loop?
So this is supposed to represent a case where I bring my loop, I make it very, so first I can make it very small, right? And then what I do is, since I said these are neutral loops, they can be annihilated by a local operation, I can take it and I can annihilate it. And then I can recreate it over here and bring it back. So this is a process where I take alpha, I annihilate it, then I recreate it over here. And so these processes differ from these processes by just some local change around here. And so you can argue that it can't change the statistical phase. That's a general property. Yeah, basically under any local deformation. So it doesn't. You can change where the path of the loop is. You can also do things more non-trivial, like act on it by local operators. Any of those kinds of local deformations can't change the phase. As long as it's a local operator, which is acting far from where the other loop is, it doesn't change it. That's a basic principle. It's a locality principle. So we've proven that this braiding neutral loops is trivial. Now, what about the general case where loops carry charge? So in this case, you can easily show, basically, that the statistics is given by if alpha carries charge, Q alpha, and beta carries charge, Q beta, and they carry flux, phi alpha and phi beta, you can show the phase is given by Q alpha times phi beta plus Q beta times phi alpha. And why is that? Well, any loop that carries charge, we can think of it as basically a neutral loop plus some charge. And we know that braiding a charge around a loop gives you an Aronoff Bohm phase. So you can easily show when you do this braiding process, you get two contributions, braiding the charge on alpha around the flux on beta, and braiding the flux on alpha around the charge on beta. That gives you these two contributions. So this is what happens in the general case. Okay, so let's put all our results together. So we've gotten these three things. And you might be happy and say, oh, this is great. We found some interesting statistics of braiding charges around loops and also braiding loops around loops. But you shouldn't be too happy because you, our argument, all these quantities we've calculated here, they only depend on the gauge group G. They don't depend at all on the underlying bosonic matter that we've gauged, right? We never even talked about what the original model was. We could prove all these things without even talking about it. So that's bad because that means the whole point of this is we want to distinguish different bosonic models by coupling them to a gauge theory, but none of these quantities have any hope of doing that. They're all will be the same for any gauge theory with the same gauge group. So now you might get worried and say, okay, we can't do anything. We have no hope of distinguishing phases in three dimensions by their braiding statistics. But that's not true. If you think a little bit harder, you realize there is a way to do it, but you have to think about one slightly more complicated process. So here what we do is we braid, it's something involving three loops. So we have two loops, alpha and beta, that are linked with a third loop, gamma. We braid alpha, it's the same process I showed you before, braiding alpha around beta. The only difference now is that both alpha and beta are linked to gamma. And the key point here is that because they're linked to gamma, you can't shrink them down to a point without maybe leaving some residue here on gamma. So that whole argument for why the statistics was given by that simple Aronoff-Bohm formula breaks down. So there's room for interesting phases, interesting statistical phases in this setup. And in fact, they do arise, as I'll show. So the phase associated with this process we'll call, so I'm going to assume it's abelian in this discussion. There are non-abelian cases. You can have non-abelian loop statistics, but in this talk, I'm just going to focus on the abelian case. So the phase associated with this process is, we call it theta alpha beta comma c. You might say, why don't you call it alpha beta gamma? And the reason is that it's pretty easy to see that the statistical phase associated with this process is independent of how much charge is attached to gamma. Attaching charge to gamma shouldn't change anything because it's sort of by locality. So it should only depend on the flux carried by gamma. And that's what this notation says, because C basically by definition is just basically describes the flux carried by gamma up to some factors of 2 pi over n. So I'm making that explicit here, and that's why I use this notation, alpha beta C. Okay, so that's the definition of this three loop statistics. Before I sort of tell you some results, I just have to tell you one more thing, which is sort of how to describe the statistics in a convenient way. So suppose you measure some statistics in somehow in a lab and you want to convey it to someone else. What's the data you should tell them? So it turns out there's some very simple data that completely characterizes the statistical structure. And the idea is that it's enough to just tell your friend, instead of telling them all the statistics of all the excitations, it's enough to tell them the statistics of taking a unit fluxes, so things that carry flux of type 2 pi over n for one of the gauge fields and 0 for all the other gauge fields. And the reason it's enough to think about unit fluxes is that you can build up all the other more complicated fluxes from the unit fluxes. And you can also convince yourself that the statistics obeys a kind of linearity property. So you can kind of build them all up from this data. So it's enough to think about the statistics of a unit type I flux and a unit type J flux with a unit type K. We call that the base loop, the thing that's linked to. So then you can summarize the statistics with a single tensor. We call it capital theta IJK. And it's defined to be n times the statistic, the phase associated with this process. And why do we put an n here, a factor of n? The reason is that I want this to be a well-defined quantity. And so in particular, I want it to be true for any. So this is, you take any type I flux, any type J flux, and any type K flux, and you braid them and multiply by n, and you get this number. And the point is that if I multiply by n, then you always get the same number, no matter which type I or type J or type K you pick. Because remember, for any type I flux, you can always attach charge to it and get another type I flux. But by multiplying by n here, I can that charge will drop out. Because if I attach some extra charge to I or J, and then I calculate this process, it always changes the phase by some multiple of 2 pi over n. So when I multiply by n here, that drops out. So this becomes a well-defined quantity, independent of the choice of I, j, and k. So that's why we put this n here. So that's some data. It's just a collection of numbers for any I, j, and k. And it summarizes all the statistics. So now let me tell you some result. So kind of by analogy with those two models I gave you before, let me describe some models with Zn cross Zn symmetry. It turns out to be the small symmetry where something interesting happens. So in this case, you can construct n squared different exactly soluble models that just were conjectured to belong to distinct phases. Okay? And these models are labeled by two integers, p1 and p2, each of which run from 0 to n minus 1. And you can gauge their symmetry and calculate their statistics because they're exactly solvable. And what do you find? Well, the statistics is summarized by these numbers. In this case, that I, j, and k, they just run from 1 to 2 because they're just 2 Zn's. So there are only a few numbers you have to think about, the ones I've written here. So this is like the statistics of a type 1 flux and a type 1 flux and a type 1 base. This is a type 1 flux, a type 2 flux, and a type 1 base, and so on. So if you calculate their statistics, you get these numbers. Now, the key point I want to convey is that you can see that they distinguish all these models. Every different value of P1 and P2 gives rise to a different pattern of statistics. So that proves they all belong to distinct phases. So that's good. So and similarly, as I said, you could do this, you can get a similar result for any phase with abelian symmetry. You get a similar result. Okay, so I don't know if I probably don't have time for this last piece. When did we start?
12:25.
I see. Okay. So maybe I should stop here. So the last part of the
you can go on.
I can go on. Okay. All right. Well, let me try to be quick here. So the last thing I wanted to do was just I promised you that you could use grading statistics not just to prove different models belong to different phases and characterize them, but also understand surface modes or prove the existence of surface modes. So let me give you one example of this in three dimensions. I'm going to give you kind of, I would say, a somewhat intuitive proof that basically any model which has non-trivial statistics in the bulk, in the sense that this capital theta is non-zero, must have gapless protected surface modes. So how does the argument work? I'm going to actually kind of go in reverse. I'm going to assume that the surface can be basically gapped. More precisely, I'm going to assume that the surface is symmetric and short-range entangled. And that basically means, you can think of this as meaning gapped, because this is a more precise statement. A gapped symmetric surface is also, so symmetric and short-range entangled basically means it's symmetric and it's not topologically ordered and it's gapped. So I'm going to assume it's symmetric and short-range entangled. And then I'm going to prove to you the statistics in the bulk is zero. That means it has trivial statistics. And this is nice because it means if the statistics is non-zero, then the surface must either break the symmetry or not be short-range entangled. If it breaks the symmetry, OK, you know what that means. If it's not short-range entangled, physically, that means it's either gapless or it's topologically ordered. OK, so that's the way it's going to work. In order to give the proof, I'm going to need two properties. I'm going to work with, although this, I'm making some assumptions about the ungauged model, I'm going to be thinking about the gauged model. So I want to claim that if the ungauged model has these properties, if the surface has these properties, then the gauged model also has some interesting properties. So what are the properties? There's two properties that the gauged surface will have. So when I say gauged surface, what I mean is I'm going to consider my model in a geometry with a boundary, and I'm going to gauge the symmetry in the presence of the boundary. So there's two properties that I claim this surface must have if you make those assumptions. So one property is that if I have a vortex loop, let's say that's near the surface, I claim that you can find a local operator which will annihilate this vortex loop near the surface. That is, if you apply this local operator, you will just get an arch like this. And that follows from the fact that the surface doesn't break the symmetry explicitly or spontaneously. And the reason is that when you bring a vortex loop to a surface, it basically creates a domain wall. And as long as your symmetry isn't broken explicitly or spontaneously, domain walls are local objects. They can be annihilated locally. Okay, that's the first property. The second property is that if I have a small arch like this, I can shrink it to a point and I can either annihilate it or turn it into a charge by some local transformation. And where does that come from? Well, that comes from the short-range entanglement assumption. As long as the surface is short-range entangled, then the only excitations at the surface, the only point-like excitations at the surface, are basically the charge and vacuum particle. So if I shrink it down, it must be equivalent to either a charge or to vacuum. So those are the two properties that I'm going to use. They follow from my two assumptions. Okay, sorry. I went back. Okay, so now let me just give you the argument. So the argument is consider the following thought experiment. We braid alpha around beta in the bulk. Now let's deform alpha and beta, and it won't change the phase. So I can stretch alpha and beta like this, and I should still get the same statistical phase that I got before, because it's independent of deformations. Now, when it's near the surface, I can apply a local operator by property one and turn these into arches. So now my process involves braiding two arches around each other. Again, it should be the same phase as my original process. Now I bring gamma down to the surface. Again, it should be the same phase. And now again, I use property one to annihilate this at the surface. Again, it has to be the same phase as in the bulk. And now finally, I can unwind gamma, turn it like this. And again, my statistical phase shouldn't change. Now finally, the last step, we're braiding these two arches around each other. This is very similar to braiding the two loops around each other in the bulk. You can make exactly the same argument and argue that the phase associated with this is given by the charge of alpha times the flux on beta plus the charge on beta and the flux on alpha. And the reason is that both of these guys can be shrunk down to either a point or a charge, just like in the original 3D case. All right, now we're ready to prove the result. So what have we shown? So the theta in the bulk, by definition, is n times the statistical phase for this bulk process. But I showed you the bulk process was the same thing as braiding the two arches. So it's n times the phase of the braiding the two arches. But braiding the two arches, I showed you, was the same thing as this sort of RNF bone phase, because they could be annihilated locally. And now this phase here is a multiple of 2 pi over n, because these are 2 pi over n, and these are integers. So this whole thing is just 0. So I proved to you that if the surface is symmetric and short-range entangled, the statistics is 0. Conversely, if the statistics is non-zero, the surface can't be gapped and can't be symmetric and short-range entangled. So that proves the result. I'm sorry I've been a little fast, but just to summarize, I've tried to show you that you can use statistics to distinguish phases and to understand their protected boundary modes, and also that in the 3D case, you have to go think about statistics involving three loops, that this is a fundamental process. And I'll stop there. Thanks for your attention. Well, what I've shown you here, I've given you one argument here, is that, let's go back to what I claimed. I said that if theta is non-zero, then the surface must be either break the symmetry or not be short-range entangled. So that means if theta is non-zero and the surface is symmetric, it can't be short-range entangled. So that means it must either be, what are 2D systems that are not short-range entangled? We really only know two examples, either sort of systems with power law correlations or systems that are topologically ordered. That's the precise statement I can prove.
Meaning, if you think about the surface, it's a sphere, geometry still can be unique from state.
I haven't talked about the degeneracy of the surface, because that may depend on topology and so on. I'm just proving to you surface is not short-range entangled. But I think that that's the precise statement you can prove. But I think you can say, okay, that's roughly speaking what the tells you it's either power law or topologically ordered.
Is there any way of doing this in like one dimensions where you put on some kind of Y network or something?
It's a good question. I don't really know how to do it in one dimension. Maybe there's a way. In one dimension, I should say there are other methods to basically prove. Give a more or less complete classification in one dimension. But yeah.
So when the surface is long-range entangled,
yeah.
Which property of the boundary topological feature is encoded in the tethers?
Good question. Yeah. So there is a you can derive a, I haven't discussed it here, but there's a formula that connects statistics, various the statistics of the surface to the bulk statistics. So you can actually, you can derive what the bulk statistics is from knowing certain statistics on the surface. If you make the argument I gave here a little bit more quantitative. So yeah. So there is a formula that relates them.
Can there be a system with non-trivial three-root of rating statistics, but trivial two-root rating statistics? Or is that just impossible by some general considerations?
Well, the two-loop statistics, I guess I tried to argue, was always trivial.
The two-loop with the non-neutral two-loop statistics. So particle loops.
The non-neutral. So that the two-loop statistics is always given by the Aronoff-Bohm formula. That's what I was trying to argue, that it's fixed. For any gauge theory as defined in this way, a gauged short-range entangled state, I tried to argue that two-loop statistics is always given by that formula.
Sure, but the question is, can there be a hypothetical system for which this Aronoff-Bohm base is zero, but somehow you still get the non-trivial?
So what does it mean that it's zero? So I'm not sure how, maybe we could, I'm not sure how it could be. So you mean zero for any choice of loops? So, but the way the formula is written, at least, again, I talked about abelian groups here. The formula was something like theta alpha beta equals q alpha phi beta plus q beta phi alpha. So how can the, so for some choices of q and phi, it will be non-zero. I'm not sure. Yeah, maybe we can discuss.
So, in the case of non-abelian groups, you can put your gauge model on a torus and consider some generalized steam integers, right? But does this way of thinking, can you also like put it in non-abelian groups?
non-abelian groups. So in principle, I don't see any reason why you can't discuss all these things in non-abelian case. We haven't investigated non-abelian groups just because it's more complicated. But I think you can still define statistics. You can't summarize them by phases. You have to start talking about F symbols and R symbols and all the whole quantum dimensions that all you're going to have to. But you could, in principle, that all that data can be defined. So for any fixed base, once you fix the base, you kind of have it. You can talk about taking loops, you can think about fusing them together, you can think about braiding them around each other, and then that whole structure of a 2D topological phase exists for every fixed base. So you can define that whole set of data.
But for non-abelian groups, there can be excitations that are not just simple loops, maybe not.
Yeah, even for, well, yeah, that's right. Even for abelian groups, you could have weird things like that, but I don't know what to do with that. Yeah. I mean, I don't know how to define any interesting quantities for things beyond loops, but maybe it's possible.
It's related. Do you see why three was enough? Like why you didn't need to think about more complicated objects anymore?
Well, so just one thing to clarify. I think maybe the name is a little confusing. Really, it's not just three in some sense, right? You can consider any number all linked with this base and braid them in arbitrary ways. Now, for abelian case, just knowing what happens with two is enough to figure out even more complicated processes involving six. I can break them up into local little things. But I don't know. If you're asking whether there could be more structure beyond this, it's possible. We don't know any examples of new data which is independent, which can't be calculated from this data, but it could be there.
Okay, well, thanks again.